This is Germ Warfare, the battle of ideas.
My name is Germ. This is Germ Warfare, the battle of ideas. Mark Gober, thank you for joining me in the trenches.
Hey, Germ, thank you for having me.
Yeah, we were just talking a moment ago. You're from the States, but you're in Europe at the moment. I'm quite jealous.
I am indeed, and we're on the same time zone, which is synchronous.
That is a great thing, because it's always difficult to find easy time zones when you do podcasts. Okay, so in your view, let's just jump straight into it. Why is everything upside down?
Well, let me give you some backstory, because I've now written 6 books, and they all start with and end upside down X. So an end upside down thinking, and end upside down medicine, and end upside down liberty, and so forth. But I didn't start off, number one, thinking I would ever write books. And number two, thinking that I'd write a series about how everything is upside down. It started with just one book on the nature of consciousness, the nature of reality, and end to upside down thinking. And I thought I was done. People said, are you going to write more books? And I said, what, are you crazy? And then as I've learned more about different areas of the reality that we inhabit, both from a metaphysical perspective, but also from just a conventional perspective of how this world functions, I'm realizing the inversions that are everywhere. But my background is very much a traditional one. I wasn't thinking about this stuff growing up. I went to Princeton University for undergrad. I was a competitive tennis player growing up. I played tennis in college, worked in investment banking in New York. Actually, during the financial crisis of 2008 is when I started working. I spent about a decade in Silicon Valley advising technology-focused companies. So that was my world was much more traditional. And while I was working in Silicon Valley, I started listening to podcasts. It was in 2016. And I started to hear ideas that questioned my view of reality, which at the time, I would describe it now as a materialist perspective, where I thought everything was just made of matter and that there's no spiritual dimension to existence, and that anything that people call spiritual or religious, that's just, those are superstitions that science was teaching us. Those things aren't real. And then I realized, wow, there's actually scientific evidence. People are studying certain phenomena. And if there's reality to this, then I need to think about my own reality and who and what I am. And that might inform how I think about living life. And it's clearly led me on a path to explore many areas, ultimately leaving my firm in Silicon Valley, where I'd made it to a partner role, but I wanted to explore these other areas and needed to give myself space. So I would just say, in summary, the more I look at every area, seemingly, the more I'm realizing that the way I used to think things worked is inverted. And that's probably for a combination of reasons. Some is just an unwillingness to challenge paradigms. It's much easier to stick with what we've been taught in school and what the media tells us, but probably also some nefarious forces that want to keep us in a state of ignorance. That is an unavoidable consequence of looking into all this.
Why you, and by extension, why so few others in terms of being able to see?
Well, it hasn't come easily. It's taken a lot of effort and energy and dedication to learning about a topic and saying, I'm going to explore this to the fullest. I was in many ways trained to do this without realizing it. When I went to Princeton for undergrad, one of the requirements in most of the majors, including the one that I was in, was to write a senior thesis. So I had to write and to take in a lot of information. But then professionally, especially my job in Silicon Valley, I worked with intellectual property and business strategy. So that means I had to learn about new technologies in a variety of industries, things I didn't know anything about, and then also learn the legal implications of it, and then be able to summarize it and synthesize it to a board of directors, senior management team, CEOs, things like that. So I was very accustomed to being under high pressure situations and having to synthesize a lot of stuff, but also looking at paradigms being challenged, because that's what happens in the world of intellectual property. Someone has a new idea, and in order to get a patent, you need to come up with something that is novel and non-obvious to a person having ordinary skill in the art. So I was used to seeing paradigms being challenged and seeing the thinking process of how the mainstream was trying to suppress it or was resisting it. So I think all of that primed me to be able to look into many other areas and not to be scared of it. But you're reminding me of something a friend of mine said, who's a doctor. And when I was first telling him about my consciousness research, I said, can you believe all this stuff? Look at all this data. And I was showing him the evidence. And he said, Mark, you might be right about this stuff, but my life is good the way it is, and I don't want to rock the boat, so I'm not going to explore this. I've come across that a lot. This is a destabilizing path, and I can understand why people might want to just say, I'm not going there. My opinion is, if we want to live our best lives, we need to get in line with the nature of reality in all ways, and therefore we shouldn't shy away from it. That's just my personal perspective.
When you say nature of reality, what do you mean?
Who are we? What are we doing here? How does the world actually work? What's actually true versus deception?
So it's like the Matrix, the red pill versus the blue pill.
Yeah, that's a good way to summarize it.
And the majority of people prefer that blue pill.
It seems that way. Although I am noticing a trend where people are being forced to ask questions because certain things are becoming so obvious. Many of those you've covered on your show. And I think a big part of this, if we want to call it an awakening, it's a multifaceted awakening to me. And that's been my own experience, is that technology is enabling this. So podcasts are really central. It started my journey to make information accessible in spite of the censorship on social media and other places. We're seeing stuff get out there. So that's big. And the information's coming from so many different sources that even the people that want to hide they're not able to hide from everything, it seems.
How do you filter through all that information coming from different sources? I mean, on the one hand, it's a blessing, but on the other hand, it might be a vice.
It's really challenging because not all information is true or high quality. So it's almost like when I start a process, I take in everything. I don't filter it. I want to know what everyone says because I also want to know the things that aren't true and then have a reason in my own mind as to why I don't agree with it. So I like to take it all in. And it's sort of like a Venn diagram of circles that overlap. When you see things coming up consistently in a pattern from independent sources, to me, that has a higher likelihood of being true. But in many of these situations, I look at things from a probabilistic lens where I say, this thing is likely to be true. It's more likely than this. And therefore, because I have to live, I'm going to live as if this is a true thing, but I'm willing to change my mind. So it's constantly, like I said, it's a destabilizing way of living because I don't feel like I have a sense of certainty with many things. But we also get data where we might have a hypothesis. And for me, because I'm in a position of writing books and speaking in a public way, I know there's documentation of the things that I say when I say them. And then the world seems to either validate or not those beliefs. So there is a checks and balances, trial and error to this, where we can then fine tune our discernment and also learn more about the sources that we're getting information from.
The last few years, I think, have been a remarkable catalyst for people waking up. I think it's the fastest awakening that I can remember.
It's been incredible. And the irony for me is that I started my journey, like I said, in 2016. My first book, It Ends Upside Down Thinking, was published in 2018. And I was working with, like, what's the nature of reality? What's our consciousness? Which is a fundamental thing, because if we didn't have a consciousness, we wouldn't even be able to ask these questions. And coming into 2020, I had just left my firm because I said I need to give myself space to explore other things. I didn't realize how many other paradigms there were to challenge. But synchronistically, when I left my job, that was when COVID happened and there were the lockdowns, and I was in the Bay Area at the time, which lockdowns were pretty extreme there and the measures were extreme. So I had the space to see what was happening. And I saw the censorship immediately, where there were doctors who said, hey, the situation is not quite what they're telling you in the media, and they're taking off YouTube. It was just so obvious for those who had the time and the willingness to look at this stuff, where I said, wow, what did I miss in my early explorations? Because I thought I was hitting on some pretty important topics. There's some big stuff that I missed. So my awakening in many ways also started in 2020, and I'm not the only one, clearly. So this is one of the paradoxes I've seen in all the work and things I look into, which is that crisis and suffering and pain can lead to evolution if we absorb it in a proper way, where we can grow from this sort of thing. So yeah, there are many terrible things that we can talk about from the COVID era. But like you say, Germ, it's led to a massive awakening and it's continuing to do so.
Yeah, I'm always a fan of looking for silver linings. I think people on our side, quote unquote, often fall into the trap of ultra cynicism.
Totally agree. I mean, there's always a balance of understanding darkness and deception and knowing that it's real, but not getting sucked into it. And I've experienced this myself acutely because there's some dark rabbit holes to go down, and there's reality to some of it. There's some real evil in the world that I wasn't even aware of. And we see pieces of it rising to the surface. And the trick is to know those things exist and not be consumed by it, because that is a danger. So to be able to hold that darkness, so to speak, and then also see that the light is there too, because if it were all darkness, how could we even be having this conversation? How could it be that so many people are realizing what's going on? So there is a duality in this world. I like the yin yang symbol, that there's the dark and the light together and there's the intermixing. I think that's a good symbol for it. So it's holding the attitude of hope and knowing that there is a way out of this and that we're all proving that by liberating ourselves through our own mind and then knowing that the darkness exists too.
So what about the COVID era for you was inverted? I've done a bunch of shows on this, so I'm most likely going to agree with you, but I'm nevertheless wanting to know.
It started for me. Well, there were multiple facets of this when I began in 2020, because I was looking at the injections. I don't know what, I want to avoid certain keywords to keep your platform. Okay.
Okay. You can say anything you want. I don't care.
So vaccines, that was something I hadn't looked into much, but it, you know, early in COVID, that's what everyone, the contrarians were saying, this is a vaccine agenda. This is about taking away liberties. So I was looking into vaccines then, and I was surprised at what I found about the ingredients and some of the lack of good science on safety and things like that. And then also I was looking from a political perspective, what's going on? What are the solutions to this politically? So that was a new area for me, because prior to 2020, I was apolitical. I didn't care at all. It wasn't something of interest, but 2020, you basically had to start having an opinion. There was no way out of it. And then there was the 2020 election. And later on, in 2023.
Election.
Yes. Whatever we want to call those things. At the time, I wasn't aware of this stuff, Derm. I was very naive as to how this works. So it was shocking to me, like probably many members of your audience, of how it actually works. Is the system fair in the way that we're taught growing up in school? And the answer is a resounding no. So I ended up, my book, An End to Upside Down Liberty, argues for what's known as voluntarism.
It's basically the anarchism.
Anarchism is a charged term, but it means the same thing. So anarchism is a society without rulers, but there are rules. It's just within a privatized manner. So anarcho-capitalism is another term for it. The idea is that, yes, government performs important functions for society. The question is whether it should be government that performs them. And government could be regarded as a compulsory political monopoly. And it's just human beings performing functions where they get paid no matter what because they collect taxation. If you take those same functions and put them in a marketplace, if you don't do a good job as the service provider, you go out of business. And so there's competition and there are reasons for that. And I go into the theoretical economics, known as the Austrian School of Economics.
Yeah.
There's the Mises Institute in Auburn, Alabama, where I've spoken twice, actually, at their economics research conference. This is becoming a more popular way of looking at economics. And I think it's superior to the way we do it. But this was stuff I hadn't considered before. The arguments people were making is, well, if we elect this person, it's going to be better. If we elect this person, it will be better. And I think on the margins, that could be true, but it doesn't seem to me that it's the solution long term to just continue to have the structure and have one group that imposes its will on the others. I mean, really, democracy, which is this term we hear everyone talking about like it's such a good thing, it's the tyranny of one group of people over others. It's just sort of a distributed tyranny where it's not one person doing it, it's one group. But what happens if that one group it makes an error or is not intelligent and they get to impose their will? That's a form of tyranny to me. So, we have a compulsory democracy where you are subjected to the will of the majority or however it's done in each country, even if you don't want that. Whereas a voluntary democracy would be a little bit different, where if we all got together, we signed a contract and said, look, this is how we're going to make decisions. And that way we explicitly consent to that. And we know exactly what the rules are. And we might say, look, we're going to have this board and they're going to make the decisions in these things. Well, we've consented explicitly in that way. So that would be a voluntary democracy versus what we've got elsewhere is a compulsory democracy. And that leads to all sorts of problems.
Hans Hermann Hoppe has written a really good book on democracy versus monarchy versus natural order. What's it called? Democracy, the God That Failed. And that's a really good read.
That's a fascinating book. Also, I would recommend Murray Rothbard's book For a New Liberty, one of my favorites.
And also The Road to Serfdom also.
Yes, by F.A. Hayek, who was a Nobel Prize winner. Larkin Rose wrote a book called The Most Dangerous Superstition, which has become famous. It's a paradigm-shifting book.
I've got it, I think. There we go. The Most Dangerous Superstition.
It's a great one. It's a paradigm shift. I mean, that really rocked me to think about, wow, I was so trained to think about government as this benevolent force. And sure, we can point to examples where it has done good things, but overall, the thinking is inverted. That here's how it goes. And I first heard this from Larkin Rose. most people would say, let's say classically trained people, that we need to have a government, a group of people, because human beings are essentially stupid and irresponsible and not trustworthy. So the solution, paradoxically, is we're going to take a subset of those people that we don't trust, and we're going to put them in power over the rest of them. The logic actually breaks down, because if you don't trust people, then why would you trust them in power? And some people would be like, Mark, you don't understand. This is why we have elections. Mm. And then I'd say, well,
what, you're going to vote your way to freedom.
Well, you just told me you don't trust people, and you trust them well enough to vote the right person into power, and you trust them to run elections responsibly. The logic breaks down.
Vote harder, bro.
That's the thinking these days, I guess.
One of my tugs of war with which I grapple is the other side of the coin. When everything's privatized, you end up with Google, Facebook, Microsoft, Amazon. These are massive, massive companies with the ability to completely change the way in which people think and even vote, for example.
Yeah, this is one of the challenges in talking about voluntarism versus the current paradigm is known as statism, which is having government, compulsory government, however it's done. And the way I look at voluntarism is that it's imperfect, but it's less bad than the status quo. Yes, there will be problems. This is why people have a hard time thinking about it, because you'll immediately go to the one thing that doesn't work and say, I'm not thinking about this anymore. Whereas under statism, we've become very comfortable with the problems, and we see them. We're like, okay, that's just okay. It's imperfect. The argument is that it's less bad to do voluntarism. So I would say, with regard to the big tech companies or any large companies in an industry, is that they don't exist in a fully privatized society. They exist with government that's doing the regulation. One of my favorite quotes is from PJ O'Rourke, who says that when buying and selling is controlled by legislation, the first things to be bought and sold are legislators. So we have this sort of cronyism where the big companies exist, but it's not in a fully free market. So they're pulling the strings likely in ways that we don't see. That doesn't mean that something like that couldn't happen within a free marketplace, but arguably it would happen because they're producing services and goods that are so superior that, for whatever reason, they're surviving in the marketplace.
And I think one of the arguments that helps what you just said is the idea that if there were no government regulations and laws protecting corporations, you wouldn't have Amazon being so big and powerful. You wouldn't have Facebook being so big and powerful. Facebook, as we know, is already linked to Central Intel in its creation, which is an extension of the state. And you have things like patents, which are all about protecting the companies.
Yep. And I know that acutely because I worked in the intellectual property industry. So it's ironic that I now see it from a different lens. But we obviously don't know everything that goes on behind the scenes, but it's not a fully private market per se, because we have these compulsory regulators. So in a privatized voluntarist society, it's not like there wouldn't be regulation. It would just be agreed upon by the parties in the marketplace. Right now, some might say that we're agreeing to it because we live in a country and we're voting, but it's very much indirect. It's an implied consent. Whereas if you had these competitive marketplaces, people will be flocking to where it's objectively better. And that means there's incentive for new competition to come about. And that's the argument that you'll see in all of these. And there are, of course, counter arguments to how it could be problematic. But the question is, what's worse? The current system, where you can buy off the politicians who are then going to regulate from there, or you have another system where the rules are made up by the market participants?
And something that I thought about recently is war. People on the ground are not the ones creating wars. It's always, always the state.
It's a very good point. And then there's always a rationalization, which is that this is for the greater good. That's how it always is positioned, this very collectivistic perspective, which is that, well, if some individuals suffer, that's okay because it's for the benefit of society. And that's a dangerous mentality, because who are the ones making those judgments? What I would call a freer society under voluntarism, it's not as though there wouldn't be conflict and war and weapons. That could happen. But right now, the governments are collecting taxpayer funding, and they can print money with central banks like the Federal Reserve in the United States, and they can do things that we might not see in a more privatized society, and they can then justify things that most of us wouldn't actually want.
With regards to the COVID era, in your mind, what about it was inverted? For example, was there a pandemic?
Well, I had heard in early 2020, there was this spectrum of what some would call conspiracy theories. That was the term everyone was using then, and still somewhat today. But when it first started, people would say, no, like COVID's not that bad. Like, don't worry about it. They're the masking, like you don't need that stuff. And people would go even further and say, look, this is an agenda to be able to inject you with poison, to depopulate, to control through vaccine identifications, for example, all these various theories. And then I heard a few people saying, yeah, all that's true, everything you said. And also there's no virus. SARS-CoV-2 does not exist. So I'd heard all this stuff and I would continue to research. But on this idea that people typically now call no virus, I heard the arguments and thought, well, like I can't counter what they're saying because they're talking about really technical stuff. They're talking about the method section of virology papers. I've got other stuff to look at. So I put it aside and it wasn't going away. Like people continued to talk about it. And I figured, well, if this could be debunked so easily, surely there would be just evidence knocking the no virus theory out of the park. And it was seemed to be the reverse, where it was gaining momentum. And I started to look at it seriously in June of 2023. I went to a conference in Tennessee hosted by Courtney Turner, of the Courtney Turner podcast. And she had a bunch of people talking about politics. I was talking about consciousness and the Great Reset, which is what one of my books is about. And I met Alec Zeck in person there. And Alec was putting together something called The End of COVID, which is still available at theendofcovid.com. He was speaking about virology. He's not a scientist or a doctor himself, but was synthesizing what many of the experts, so to speak, doctors had been saying and flaws in the methods of virology. And he invited me to speak about, on The End of COVID, but about liberty and the Great Reset and voluntarism. But because I was involved in it, I then listened to what the doctors were saying on The End of COVID. And I said, wow, they have some interesting arguments. I've got to look into this. And the deeper I went into it, I came to the conclusion, and this is in my book, An End to Upside Down Medicine, that the scientific method, at the very least, is not being followed in virology, meaning, and I know you've had guests talking about this on your show, there's no independent variable in the virology studies, meaning you don't have a sample of just the virus by itself. There's other stuff in there because of the methods that they use. And that's a problem if your sample in the study, if you're trying to show that this thing causes disease, and you've got other stuff in it, that's a very big problem. There's no independent variable. And then they often don't run proper controls. So that's a problem from the scientific method perspective. And then also, if you don't have an independent variable, what are you even controlling against if you don't know what's in that sample? So that's really problematic. And I just couldn't believe, whoa. And that doesn't mean there's no virus just on its own. It just means they're not following the scientific method, which is like the opposite of what we hear. This is a pseudoscience by definition, but we hear on TV and through the media, this is all scientific stuff. And the deeper I go into it, it seems as though they're unable to demonstrate contagion. And first of all, if you have an isolated sample, then how do you even know what's going to be transmitted from person to person? But the way they run the studies to try to demonstrate contagion of whether it's SARS-CoV-2 or other alleged viruses, they're doing it in unnatural ways on animals typically. So they're injecting this unpurified sample of fluid into an animal's brain or in their trachea, and some of them get symptoms and they say, look, there was a virus there, versus what I would have expected from those sorts of studies where, look, if the virus is so contagious and deadly, just take a little bit of it and give it to some organisms, ethics aside, and see if they all come down with the same symptoms. Because look, if this thing is so contagious, you should be able to do that. And I wasn't seeing that sort of evidence. And I was not the only one. There are many people who've looked into this. So now what would I say? Was there a pandemic? There were symptoms for sure. People got sick. People died. And this is the case with all alleged germ-based virus-based illnesses. There are symptoms. People die. The question is, what's the cause? And that is a very deep question. It's actually separate from whether or not a virus exists. Then why do people get sick is another question. And that's multifaceted. I think it's multifactorial. There are toxins in the world, in the food that we eat, in the buildings that we enter, in the air, which is a whole other topic. Nutrition is very important. EMFs, so the radiation that's all over the place from our wireless devices and other sorts of things. Electricity itself. There's a book called The Invisible Rainbow that goes through the history of electricity and how that could affect things. And then also consciousness. This is a big part of all my work. How might our mindset affect health? But even on a metaphysical level, could there be a resonance? Some call it bioresonance between people, where if one person is detoxifying, could that be quote unquote contagious in a way that modern medicine doesn't understand? The point is, this is very complex, and modern medicine and the allopathic approach is very reductionistic. It likes to say, there's this one thing, this is what causes your symptoms, and you need to take this one pill or injection or whatever to fix it. It's very simplistic, and I think it's way more complex in reality.
I've actually thought about the same thing as that. For example, why do people yawn together? I mean, there's no contagion going on there, but something else is happening. And laughter or crying, all of these things create a ripple effect around you. And I also do wonder if there is some sort of resonance.
I mean, this challenges so many scientific paradigms, and I think that's one of the reasons we don't hear about it talked as much. It challenges what PhDs and MDs at many universities and institutions believe. They believe that things typically have a physical effect or physical cause. Whereas if we flip the materialist paradigm and say that, look, consciousness and energies are way beyond what we're typically taught, these other ideas that you mentioned, and I agree with you, they're possible. They're not anomalies. They're actually what you'd expect in a different reality. Another example is women's menstruation cycles, which can synchronize when they live together. This is a non-material thing, seemingly. And look, there could be things like pheromones, which some people would argue, but there could be something energetic. And that's what I get into in the second half of my book. I'll give one example. Larry Dossey, who's a medical doctor, who I've actually interviewed on my podcast, Where Is My Mind, on the topic of consciousness, he references telesomatic events, often between identical twins. These are instances where one twin is injured, let's say burned, and the other twin, who wasn't burned and wasn't even in the same location, has a physical manifestation of a burn. Telesomatic events. So look, these are not, they're not common. They apparently occur a lot in identical twins. I think something like 30% is what Dr. Larry Dossey says. And among people who are emotionally close, these sorts of things can are more prevalent. Same with mental telepathy, where there's scientific evidence for that too, done in controlled scientific studies. It opens up a whole can of worms, because if our body is not, first of all, maybe has a biofield that can pick up things, but also might not be as physical in the way that we think about it, that reality has different qualities than we understand. Then we have to think about, well, what's a human being? And if we think about a human being differently, then clearly we have to think about health differently.
Yes, exactly. I mean, in your books, they're all about the inversion of reality. And of course, one of the threads, as you just pointed out, throughout all of your work is consciousness and the nature of being, etc. And as difficult as what it is to create a segue, One of those threads is into the sort of the paranormal. How does that link to consciousness, and where is the inversion?
Well, the term paranormal comes from the materialist perspective, which assumes that normal is consciousness comes from the brain. That's the materialist paradigm. The consciousness could be defined as our capacity for experience, the part of us that experiences, that is aware, for example. And the challenge in defining consciousness is that we can't point to it. We don't see it, but we have it because it's the part of us that's registering this conversation right now. Mm-hmm. Our thoughts appear within consciousness. So I say to you, hey, Germ, I had this thought. I had a thought. The I is the sense of consciousness. I ate this. I heard this. I is consciousness. So this is really fundamental and important. And the materialist perspective, most of mainstream science says that consciousness we all talk about, it comes from our brain because of chemical and electrical activity. And there are neural correlates of consciousness, NCC for short. Because look, if you get in an accident and damage a part of the brain typically believed to be responsible for vision, we can point to where the brain was damaged and we can see where you now have problems in vision or memory, and so forth. And then they say, okay, well, the brain creates consciousness. The problem from a logical and philosophical perspective is that correlation does not necessarily imply causation. So just because two things are related doesn't mean that one causes the other. And an analogy I've heard used by many people is if you have a fire, firefighters show up. And if you have a larger fire, there might be more firefighters. So you could say, look, there's a strong correlation between the size of the fire and the number of firefighters that showed up. Therefore, the firefighters caused the fire. And we would say, no, you just drew the wrong conclusion. So this comes up in medicine too, where people observe things and then they jump to a causal explanation for it. So let's look at the brain situation. We know there's a correlation between the brain activity and conscious experience. The brain's clearly involved in some way, but what else could explain that beyond the brain creating consciousness? Well, if the brain is like an antenna receiver, that could explain it too. So if you're watching television and there's an antenna picking up the signal and you're watching a TV show, Then you take a hammer and smash the antenna. All of a sudden, that show you're watching, it's very scratchy on the screen. It's not a clear picture anymore. It's not because the signal was damaged. All that was damaged was the apparatus responsible for processing and filtering and receiving that signal. So maybe the brain acts in that capacity where it's a filtering mechanism or a transducer, something like that. Well, all of a sudden, that's interesting, because we still can explain correlation, but maybe these other phenomena like telepathy and so forth, near-death experiences, we can explain that stuff. And one more analogy before I pause. It comes from a philosopher named Dr. Bernardo Kastrup. He views all of reality to be made of consciousness fundamentally, and the material world is a manifestation of consciousness at the very deepest level. He calls it analytic idealism. Some would call it idealism generally. And the analogy he uses is that there are whirlpools in a stream of consciousness. So imagine an infinite stream of water. Water's like consciousness in the analogy. And we're like whirlpools. We're individuations of the water. So if some of the water from one whirlpool gets into another whirlpool, the analogy there is that some of one person's consciousness is getting into another person's individuated consciousness. That's a telepathic effect. So this model of reality would predict that psychic phenomena would be real. They're not paranormal. They're not anomalies. They're actually predicted. And likewise, if one whirlpool stops being a whirlpool, it delocalizes. That's like if one person's body dies, their consciousness doesn't die. It simply transitions into a new form.
Let me play devil's advocate. What if you're just looking too deeply into everything? What if everything really is just hypermaterialistic?
I mean, it's always a possibility with this stuff. What I say is that there's only one thing I can actually prove definitively, which is that at this moment, it feels like I'm conscious. It feels that way. I can't even prove the past. I can't prove what we just talked about 2 minutes ago, because it's a memory that occurs in the present moment. It's a very compelling memory. But if we wanted to be really strict about it, one thing I know, it feels like I'm conscious in this moment. So you're right. The materialist model could be true, but it's to me, it's the preponderance of evidence. It points more and more toward these quote unquote anomalies that challenge materialism. It's much easier to explain with an alternative framework. And in my first book, An End Upside Down Thinking, I was asking that question, Durham, and I still do. And I'm like, you know, I was working in Silicon Valley, working with big tech companies and things like that, and thinking about publishing a book on this topic. I said, I need to put as much evidence, much credible evidence as I can. Peer-reviewed science, the US government ran a psychic spying program, look at their declassified documents, look at stuff from medical doctors, PhDs and things like that. Look at quantum physics and all this stuff. And like I said, the preponderance of evidence points us away from materialism. There's too much in independent areas. And that's what that book is. It's chapter after chapter, one chapter on the evidence for telepathy, another one on psychokinesis, mind-matter interaction, and so forth. All these things, to me, it's too hard to shoot every single thing down. And if there's one anomaly that's true, materialism has a very hard time explaining it, whereas an alternative paradigm can explain it and accommodate it very easily.
That's also something that separates humans from animals in many ways. I mean, an elephant won't look at a mirror and go, dude, is that me?
Well, now we're getting into definitions of consciousness and versus self-awareness, because I do have a chapter in that book, and also in my podcast series, I interviewed Dr. Rupert Sheldrake, a Cambridge biochemist, former Cambridge biochemist, who's studied this, where studies on animals who seem to have psychic abilities, where they know their owner's coming home and they control for the variables that most people would say, a skeptic would say, well, that couldn't be. So what Dr. Sheldrake did was he would have a video camera on the dog at home or the animal, and then he would send the owner far away from home at a randomly scheduled time, not in the owner's typical car, not even to a place the owner would even know about. And when the owner decides to go home, the video on the dog shows the dog going to the window, and he's got this is available online, Dr. Rupert Sheldrake. And he wrote a book, Dogs That Know When Their Owners Are Coming Home and Other Phenomena Like It. I think that's the subtitle. There might be something going on with animals where they have a consciousness, but it's a different type of conscious experience than what the human experiences, because they do have a different biology, different brains, for example. So they might not have the same level of self-awareness that a human does. It might just be that I think about it as like driving a car. There are different cars you can drive. Someone drives a Porsche, another person drives a Toyota. The car is going to do what the car is going to do because it has its limitations and its qualities, but the driver can do the best it can with that vehicle. It might be like we're just different vehicles, but we're consciousnesses operating those vehicles.
What would be the point of everything being upside down?
Deep question. Think about it all the time, because it really begs the question, what is the nature of this reality that we inhabit? How could it be, especially if there is some metaphysical, spiritual reality to everything? Materialism's wrong. It's not all random and meaningless. Let's say there's something deeper here. Then why would it be that we exist in this reality in which so much is inverted? And there seems to be an intentional ignorance. That's the only thing I can rationalize. I mean, I know all the things I learned in school and in the business world, and I thought I had a pretty good grip on reality after all the work and studying I did, and I'm not the only one. And I was wrong about everything, basically. And now, or let's just say far off, because there might be elements of what I used to believe that I still do, but I was directionally speaking, way off. How could that be? The most benevolent, innocent explanation is, well, look, we're just evolving and we're growing, we're making mistakes. And that's part of it, that human nature makes mistakes and we do grow and and people don't like to admit mistakes. But I do think there's something deeper going on. There's a quote I've been referencing a lot recently from Dr. Mario Beauregard, who's a neuroscientist, and he's been studying spiritual phenomena, which is controversial to do. Many of the people that talk that study these things, they have to worry about getting tenure. They have to be quiet before they get tenure. It's risky for an academic. So I would consider him one of many brave scientists out there. And he said he was told by the head of a large neurological institute in Canada, the head of this institute said to him, "As long as I'm here, you will never be able to study the science of spiritual phenomena." And he said, this is clearly social engineering. And that's where I'm starting to lean. Yes, there's the ignorance, the innocent ignorance, and the egos involved and people not wanting to admit they're wrong. But there's something deeper that is actually preventing information from getting out. And that has a ripple effect, because that means less funding, because it's so risky. Number one, for the funder to be associated with it. And then for the academic to want to spend time. Most of the funding is going to the more traditional areas. So then we end up with this bias that starts to reinforce itself. And that could explain to me where we are, not just with regard to consciousness, but so many other areas. We see it in virology and medicine, basically everything, and probably other ones I haven't even looked at yet, where there's just a belief system. There's a presupposition that something is true. And if you look deeply at where those assumptions came from, it's just something that's deeply entrenched that hasn't been challenged enough.
Climate change. You haven't mentioned it.
Yeah, that's one I talk about in my book called An End to the Upside Down Reset, which is about the Great Reset. And I break the Great Reset down after reading Klaus Schwab's book. It's called COVID-19, The Great Reset, by the way. It's all out in the open. And one of the six categories of the Great Reset to me is climate or environment broadly, but really they're focused on climate. And more specifically, that it's caused by human beings. And more specifically, that there are certain people who know what to do about it. And that involves taking away rights. And that's where my antennae go up when they say, well, just trust us and now then it's going to be okay. So maybe we need to limit eventually how much you travel, your CO2 emissions. Maybe we should limit what you eat. That's where it becomes a potential weaponization. And we see this with COVID too and other quote unquote invisible enemies. There's an enemy out there and we're going to save you from it. And by the way, it involves just giving away some of your rights, but it's okay because it's for the greater good. I think climate, that field fits into that pattern.
Oh, but Mark, you're just being a denier. You should trust the experts.
I know. I hear that a lot. And some people might say, Mark, what are you doing? You're not a PhD in these topics. You're not a medical doctor. How can you talk about all this stuff? Well, I can quote people and cite their research because there are credible people on all sides of the spectrum. Sometimes not as many in areas that are more controversial, but there are quote unquote experts who have challenged things that we can point to. And we are allowed to synthesize what other people say. And also we're being asked to make decisions. So yeah, we're not everyone's a PhD or a medical doctor, but there was a proposition that we all had to face, which was take the shot. So we had to become our own doctors, however we want to look at it. And we can look at other areas of life too, where we have to make our own decisions. And that means we have to critically examine what people say and look at their presuppositions. That's the way I would synthesize all this. A person's opinion is based on certain assumptions. And what we need to do, I think, is look at those assumptions and find out where they came from. Often they're ancient, and that could be decades old, like in the field of virology. The method, which is known as the cell culture, quote unquote, isolation method, which is not actually isolation in the traditional definition, that came from 1954, Enders and People study. That's the gold standard. But we're pretty far away from that. So most people aren't even thinking about it. And then to actually go read those early papers and what were they doing? That's the sort of analysis that's required, because many experts, and I've talked to tons of doctors about this, they'll say, well, you know, I think viruses exist and cause disease because that's what I read in my med school textbook. And this is how you treat it. And these are the things that you do. But how often are the experts even questioning the presuppositions? Because number one, it's much easier to just go along with what they're told. But in the case of doctors, it's really hard to get into med school. It's quite an accomplishment to get in. And then it's very competitive once you're in and you want to get a good residency or a fellowship in the US and that sort of thing. Do you have time to sit there and say, there's this one line in the textbook where they assumed that this virus exists and causes these symptoms. Could there be other reasons for it? And what were the methodologies? I mean, that would just take so much time and effort to do. So I can understand why these alleged experts actually might be innocently getting it wrong.
Yeah, but that stay in your lane, trust the experts narrative, I find very annoying, because what it suggests is something that happened hundreds of years ago, whereby the average person wasn't permitted to read, say, the Bible. They had to trust it coming from the religious authority of the time. There was a death sentence, you know, if you were found reading the Holy Scriptures without permission. And it's the same type of thinking. Only trust those with a stamp of approval from a tertiary institution. That goes against the very principle of science, which is open source. Anybody should be able to read the literature, and it's all available. So why can you not think critically about it?
That's the irony, is that science is supposed to be the antidote to religion and faith, and yet it's become its own form of religion, scientism, where trust the science, meaning trust the priesthood, the individuals who represent science, versus the scientific method, which is all about challenging and trying to falsify and trying to get to the truth, versus this is the truth. And that's what we're often told. If you ask questions, then you're a danger to society. We're going to censor you. This is a big problem. This is dangerous misinformation. That's what we hear. So it's ironic that science has become its own form of religion. However, the scientific method itself is a reasonable way to try to get to truth. And then when we go to things like virology, for example, and find out the scientific method isn't being followed properly, and yet the representatives of science are taking the findings and representing it as truth, it's a complete inversion.
Why does a conversation like this matter?
I can say from my own experience that I had my own transformations from learning about new ideas. It's almost like a first domino can fall. Let's say someone's a first-time listener or viewer to this stuff. It opens a door, a new window of possibilities to look at life differently. And I'm still experiencing that with all sorts of things, where I'm taking in as much information as I can. I still listen to tons of podcasts and read lots of books, because it shifts my thinking, which then shifts my behavior and the choices that I make. And I think that's probably true for many members of your audience. But then if you want to go deeper and look from a metaphysical lens, if reality is consciousness or something like it, where consciousness is having an effect on the apparently physical world, then what happens when people have a consciousness shift? You can't see it in the same way that one billiard ball hits the next one and we can see the effects. But what if there's something non-physical happening when there's a consciousness shift, non-linear? So think about mine. I heard, let's say, the first podcast I heard that really shifted me, it was on Extreme Health Radio, 2016, a woman named Laura Powers, who claims to have psychic abilities. She's a friend of mine now. She works with people using her abilities. She claims she talks to other dimensions on a health podcast. And it didn't change my life right there, but it was enough for me to say, she's talking about this seriously in public. Like, what's going on here? And then I found out, wow, there are other people that have had these experiences. So that was a first domino that's led to now 6 books and doing all this stuff. So it's a non-linear effect. It was just an hour of my time listening to something that opened doors. So we don't know what the effects will be of hearing one piece of information down the road in terms of the consciousness shift. And I also want to add, from the perspective of psychokinesis, this is mind affecting matter. The classic studies that have been done are where people are asked to affect a machine with their mind. It's called a random number generator. This was done at Princeton University, actually. The former dean of engineering, Dr. Robert John, had a lab up until 2007 for nearly 30 years. This was one of the types of studies they did. They said, hey, Germ, I want you to make this machine. It spits out zeros and ones in a random fashion, a random number generator. I want you to make it produce more ones than zeros. And what they find is that people are able to do this. It's a very small deviation from 50-50 chance, but statistically it's significant. The implication is that the human mind has an effect on the physical world, even if it's a small one. And they've even shown that this happens on a collective scale. It's called the Global Consciousness Project, where these machines are set up all over the world. And researchers look to see whether the machines behave non-randomly during a major global event like 9/11 or Princess Diana's death, to see if strong emotion from a lot of people, even if they're not aware of the machines, are they affecting the physical world in some way? And what they find is the machines behave non-randomly. So if we just extrapolate that out, what happens when we have a consciousness shift and learn about information like this? on a metaphysical level? Could there be a physical manifestation in a way that we don't even comprehend? Our science doesn't get it. I think we have to be open to that.
Something that I've been thinking a fair amount about is the impact of AI in terms of consciousness and how we perceive reality. For example, this doesn't even involve AI, but the COVID era wasn't actually about a virus. It was about a genome sequence, and it was all about this. But that itself is just digital, and yet it became real. And there's something wrong with that, that people accept something as digital as real. And I wonder now where AI comes in.
Well, from a consciousness perspective, this is it's a deep philosophical question. Could a machine develop consciousness? And that's distinct from intelligence, because we know using ChatGPT or any technology that the machine can do things that we validate as accurate in a very impressive way. But can it have feelings? Can it have that sense of experiencing? Can it experience love, for example? That's a different question, which we couldn't know unless we were inside of that machine. It's always going to be philosophical and theoretical. But from my perspective, consciousness doesn't emerge. New consciousness doesn't emerge from matter on its own. The machine to me is just a big computer. So it could compute things, but it's not going to have consciousness just pop out of it. Unless theoretically, I've been thinking about, let's say a machine could become intelligent enough, because we feel like we're conscious. So let's just assume that we are conscious as humans, but we're biological, whereas these AIs are not biological. But what if you had a machine that was so smart because of the way it's programmed that it could then integrate biological material into itself? So then it could become a receiver of consciousness. So then it becomes like a hybrid. I don't know. Maybe that's an interesting conversation. But if just from a strictly AI perspective, from just machine, there's a man named Federico Faggin, who is one of the original inventors of the microprocessor at Intel and other places. So this is someone who knows a lot about technology. He had a very mystical experience later in his life where he realized from direct experience that the materialist perspective is not right. And there's something much more important about consciousness. His view has been that machines will not become conscious for this very reason, that new consciousness isn't just going to pop out. That doesn't mean that machines couldn't be dangerous for other reasons. But the show Westworld on Netflix, where the machines develop emotions and then take over because they have those emotions and feelings, that would be more unlikely, more fictional from this consciousness perspective.
Yes, but that mimicry might become undetectable.
True, it could be. Well, we don't know, because it's hard to pick what are the parts of our consciousness that the machine will never grasp. And we can probably test it using AI and it's going to mimic very well, but there might be aspects that it just can't get to.
But are you concerned?
My opinion with, I think, all technology is that there's good and bad. And a lot of it depends on the users, that it can be used for good or evil. Now, ChatGPT and these generative AIs are becoming really popular. My first instinct was, this is super dangerous. It's going to displace people. They're going to use it for censorship and to brainwash everyone. And I have a lot of those concerns still. But it's been interesting because I've started to explore it. I first heard about this on a podcast called Skeptico. Alex Sekiris, the host, he's interviewed me a bunch of times. And we've gone back and forth on this virus issue, whether there's no virus or not. He's taken the more traditional perspective that viruses do exist. And I've obviously written about, well, there's this alternative using AI. How does it work if you push it? And I've gotten AI to admit after numerous prompts that virology is pseudoscience because it doesn't follow the scientific method. Viruses have not been isolated. They haven't been separated from other cellular material. And sometimes it will make excuses for it. But these are pretty big admissions from a machine that's drawing from all kinds of information. That's a pretty powerful thing. If as a user, you can get it to the point of admitting those things, because I posted a bunch of this on my Instagram and Twitter, just taking a snapshot of what the AI said about virology, because we know how much information it's drawing from to get it to admit something like that. That's an opening for someone to say, whoa, AI is also beneficial in that it's good to learn what the mainstream is thinking. You can get the mainstream opinion on anything very quickly. And then we can then learn how to counter it. So there are ways around it if we can use ninja skills, basically, because it has a wall up. Anything that's not mainstream, if you go and enter in ChatGPT, has the virus been isolated? Most likely, I mean, it will advance, but most likely it's going to say, yeah, of course, and here's the cell culture method. And it takes a bunch of questioning and getting it to look at its own logic, where sometimes it can flip. And that's a valuable thing.
I'm getting a vibe that is somewhat uplifting in general from you. Let me rephrase it. The light at the end of the tunnel, in your view, is not a train coming towards us.
I think the optimism that you're hearing is a lack of fear. I wouldn't say total
that's a good
absence.
Point.
It's not a total absence, but we can't control the world that we're in fully. There are things that are going to happen that are outside of our control, but we can control ourselves and our own mindset and the things that we do and don't do. And from that perspective, I'm very optimistic, because what else can I really control? And if we live in a universe that has an evolutionary quality to it on a spiritual level, and I lean in that direction, I can't prove it, but my books go into this, that on some level, our consciousness is learning through experience. And sometimes it can be painful in the same way that going to the gym can hurt. But then, like, I was a competitive tennis player. If I work out really hard, my performance in tennis would get better, even though it was painful. We learn through that. We grow. So I do see that evolutionary aspect, and I see that positive part of it. And I see people waking up and wanting to start basically a parallel system, because the system itself, I don't know if we can fix it. It's designed to be itself, but people are waking up on their own. So it's sort of like we have to resist in one way, in that we have to be true to ourselves, but not resist in that we understand the system is as it is, and there's only so much we can do. We should try our best, but that there are things we can do in parallel, regardless of what the system does. Like, that's, to me, true liberty. And that's something that no one can take from us. So that's a hopeful and optimistic perspective, no matter what the outcomes are outside of us.
It seems to me, though, that there's still an elephant in the room. You've been talking a lot, fairly critically, and I think correctly, about the vices, the problems of materialism. So the other end of that spectrum would be belief or spirituality or religion, or in my case, Christianity. Do you think that that plays a powerful role?
I think it's a huge role. It plays a huge role in, and I can say this from personal experience. I was basically an atheist agnostic before, and now I don't know exactly what the answer is, but I see a lot of value in religious traditions all over the world, a lot of value in the research that's being done. And it seems to converge in a general direction, even though different religions might have differences in certain areas. It leads to the belief, and it is a belief because we can't prove these things. It leads to a belief in something higher than our individual selves. And that does help to alleviate fear, because if you believe that this is it, and when your body dies, that's the end of your consciousness, which is what materialism purports. Because if the brain creates consciousness, what happens when the brain's gone? That's the end of conscious experience. And materialism also seems to imply that there's no meaning built into the fabric of reality itself. There was a big bang, it's all random, and you can create meaning, but doesn't matter in the end. But what we're talking about here is some kind of meaning that's built into the fabric of reality that we're a part of. That helps to alleviate fear, because no matter what happens in the world, there's something transcendent that we're involved in.
Yes, and that is what adds to you waking up with a smile and feeling like you have purpose.
Not that it happens that way every day, because there are ups and downs that I've experienced personally, and I've seen it in others. But directionally speaking, it's sort of like a chart of stock prices over time. If you look at the Dow Jones, over time, it's got an upward trajectory, but there are big dips. There are ups and downs along the way. It's the same thing, that the trajectory changes.
Mark, what is not upside down?
From whose perspective? Because I could say the way I look at life, I mean, the mainstream, there's a lot of upside down, but these other ideas we're talking about here are much more coherent. They're not quite as upside down. So it's a matter of perspective. But let's say the mainstream view, what's not upside down? I don't know. I mean, I have to reevaluate everything. And I've done a lot in these few years, but like, I can't make claims about a lot of things now, because I'm saying, well, I believe that because I was told in a textbook, but I need to evaluate it. So my guess is there are a lot of things that the mainstream thinks are true that I would say I'm just not sure of, that I'll say that's upside down. But it just seems like the most fundamental aspects of our reality have been inverted.
We started the conversation by you saying you went to Princeton. Well, let's talk about that for a second. That was a mainstream, conventional establishment institution.
Yeah, a lot of the people I know from Princeton have that mainstream perspective. We went through the similar things together, so I can understand it. But there's an inertia, and there's like a resistance to wanting to shift from it. But my hope is that, since I come from that background, it's one of the reasons I decided to write my first book and continue doing this, is to try to bridge to people that come from that background, to say, look, if you apply the intellect that you spent so much time on to these other areas and have an open mind, which is really the scientific way and really the intellectual way, then there's another path. And if there are people of high influence, let's say, that have these realizations, they can have a disproportionate effect. We see that with media, for example. If you get someone on a huge podcast, that can have a disproportionate effect. In the financial world, someone who's very wealthy that has an awakening, that can have a disproportionate effect. So my hope is that, because of my background, it's one of the reasons I like to talk about it on these shows, because someone who might not be inclined to even consider these ideas might for 5 seconds say, I saw where he came from and he came to these conclusions and now talking about it publicly. I'll listen just for a little bit. And that's what I'm hoping to do from my angle, because I think every person is contributing in a very different way. And part of the spiritual process is to acknowledge what we are. It's sort of like puzzle pieces in some kind of cosmic metaphysical puzzle, to acknowledge the puzzle piece that we are, what our attributes are, what our weaknesses are, and to embody that puzzle piece in the best way.
How can I get your books?
They're all available on Amazon in hard copy, Kindle, and Audible. I read all the Audibles myself. And my podcast series, which is on the nature of consciousness and the quote unquote paranormal, I interviewed many scientists and experiencers of this sort of thing. It's called Where Is My Mind? It's an 8-episode narrative produced in 2019. So there aren't new episodes, but it's still very relevant if you're interested.
Where is my mind? Ooh. Is that a Pixies reference?
It's both a Pixies reference. My producer, Matt Ford from Blue Duck Media, came up with it. And it's also very relevant to the question, what's consciousness, right? Where is it?
Mark Ober, thank you for joining me in the trenches.
Thanks, Jerm.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please visit supportjerm.com.